Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, did your brain make you do it? Or maybe it was your genetics. Scientists are finding more and more evidence that human behavior is not rational. But first, can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? With us is Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much.
Very excited about your work, your study of cooperatives, cooperative economies, and history within the United States in particular. I thought we should start with somebody that you cited, which was W.E.B. Du Bois' theory. Could you give us an idea of what that theory is exactly?
I'm actually still struggling with how best to talk about it. But basically, Du Bois argued that because African Americans were more than just marginalized, but were sort of the lowest of the low on the economic totem pole, were pretty much left out of mainstream economics, were discriminated against in all the markets, we needed to do something a little different. And that is to kind of turn inward a little bit, use what he called voluntary segregation, or what most of us talk about as solidarity economics, or even black nationalism, in terms of looking into the group itself and creating a group economy based on cooperative economics that would really make sure to deliver all the goods and services and deliver the kind of economy that would help make the whole black community prosperous and that would get us out of the oppressive system that we were in. He's got lots of great quotes, but one is about how we can use intelligent economic cooperation to enter the new city as men and women and not mules, meaning. And the new city for him was, this is at the turn of the century, he's talking about how industrialization is really going to take off and new forms of industrialization are going to be the way to prosperity, and that African Americans can use cooperative ownership and cooperative democratic forms of economics to actually propel us in a position to be unequal, if not to exceed what the mainstream U.S. capitalist economy is doing, and stop being the mules of the economy and the mules of the society and actually be the intellectual economic leaders. So it's kind of very exciting. He has another quote about being at the forefront of industrial development and even another quote about how co-ops are going to help us to insulate ourselves and isolate and insulate ourselves and form a strong economic phalanx of prosperity and economic stability so that we can't be harmed by these other forces. So it's an interesting notion about how a group of people with a common interest, in this case, class and race, can come together and use democratic cooperative economics to both our economic needs, but also to help propel us into a new and better economic system that would really help everybody.
One of the things that I find most compelling about cooperative economics is the idea of democratic workplace and the idea that it's participatory, where people actually get to make decisions together, one person, one vote, and then they share in the proceeds of it so that it's more egalitarian than a standard corporate model.
Absolutely.
So can you give us a little bit of background in terms of how these have actually worked? I'm mostly interested in the worker-owned co-ops, but I know you've studied many different forms of cooperatives. Can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how these, in a practical way, work?
Even though I've been studying all different kinds of cooperative ownership, I've focused on worker co-ops whenever I could because I really think that they're one of our most important structures and one of the best ways, as you say, to democratize capital and to really have widespread economic participation and ownership and real democracy in our economic relations. So I have studied particularly late 20th century and 21st century worker-owned co-ops, often among people of color, but not always among people of color. And I even have done some work specifically about women of color, particularly black women, in worker co-ops. And what we're finding is that worker co-ops, especially the ones that have actually been part of social mission and a social enterprise model, which would be ones like Cooperative Home Care Associates in the South Bronx of New York City, or Mandela Food Co-op in, I think it's Western Oakland in California, or some of the sewing co-ops that have been in the South. There were two in North Carolina. There's one right now. I think that's also in North Carolina, also Opportunity Threads. There's some catering co-op. Oh, and child care co-ops. So there's Child Space in Philadelphia and a few other child care co-ops and babysitting co-ops. What we're finding with these worker co-ops is that they're able to take often very low-wage jobs that we wouldn't consider good. Like when we talk about a good job, right, we mean it pretty much has a living wage. You have benefits like vacation time, sick leave, sometimes retirement benefits. You also have the ability to move up in the job, so job ladder success. So these worker co-ops have been able to take industries and businesses that normally don't do that, like home care normally doesn't even give its employees full-time work because, you know, often they're just piecing together. You might be working for an elderly couple 5 hours a day, 3 or 4 times a week, but that's not really full-time work. It doesn't usually pay a living wage. It has no benefits, et cetera. So Cooperative Home Care Associates, for example, has taken that work and done two things at the same time. The first thing is they've raised the quality of the job, but partly they've done that by raising the quality of the work. So they also have an arm that does specified training so that all of their worker owners go through the same high-quality training so they can make sure that they're giving the kind of quality work that deserves the kind of quality pay and benefits and things that they want. They're also able to piece together full-time work for women, even if it ends up that they have to work in two different people's homes. But they pull together the work so that women have full-time jobs. They also pay living wages. The members get retirement funds. They are able to give back dividends because they're a profitable business. So, and most worker co-ops are for profit, so that they actually have profits or surplus at the end that can then be divided between going back into the business and being given back to the members as dividends. So some years the women have made 25% of their initial investment in the company back in 1 year, so that they have an investment, an asset, as well as a really good job, as well as high-level training, and then they also have ability to move up in the organization. They can move from the lowest level of home care to get higher credentials in nursing. They can move over into the training arm of the company. They can move up into the management part of the company. Sort of like the old days, they can sort of stay in the business almost forever or for a long period of time because they don't get stuck in the lowest wage job or that kind of thing. And the other thing that Chaka in particular was able to do was they actually lobbied the state and city governments to reallocate Medicare money to pay for home care, which was one of the ways to up the wages for the whole industry so that when they had their living wages, they were more competitive in the industry. And we see that with some of the other groups, though not quite as successfully. See the same thing in child care, right? Raising the quality of child care work because the women own their own company. They pay attention to high-quality training. They're paid a living wage. They work well with the parents. They own part of the company, so if there are profits and surplus, they can get that back as extra, you know, return on their investment. They develop leadership skills, and so they assert themselves more in their own families, in their own communities, even on the job. A lot of these worker-owned companies are also unionized, and the union really either or both helps them to provide some of the benefits like health benefits and things, and also helps them to remember that they're owners and workers. And so how do they pay attention to the issues as workers? The union helps them do that, and then the board meetings and other parts of the company help to remind them their owners and that they can make other kinds of decisions also. And so it's an interesting collaboration. As you sort of said, it's kind of the best of both worlds. I believe it's a way to both raise the dignity of work as well as build assets. And then I really think the leadership development and the other social skills and social capital that gets developed is almost just as important as the finance capital they're able to gain.
If we contrast and actually fit this into larger economic questions and larger economic structures, one of the things I've been thinking about is that we've seen the world move into this sort of neoliberal age where increasingly the labor is contracted out, wages have been forced down because there's
right.
a competition for them.
Unions have been busted.
And unions have been busted, right. And so there's been, on one side, this move towards this competitive environment versus the co-op. But I wonder, in the shape of a neoliberal economy, which seems to be nearly global at this stage, how do these fit in? Are they proliferating? Can they become entire communities of cooperatives that work together? Or are they eventually going to get drowned out by a neoliberal economy?
The first thing let me just put on the table is, while we're definitely seeing this deunionization and kind of commodifying of work and making work worse, but also having less people have even access to jobs. So that's one movement and theme that's happening in this neoliberal world. There also is a movement in the multinationals and a lot of the corporations that are actually democratizing their workplaces more because they're realizing that they're more productive. They can get higher rates of production out of employees who actually are given more responsibility, respect, and ability to work together. So there's a lot more of these quality circles and labor management boards and things. And a lot of the most profitable multinational companies actually practice a somewhat of workplace democracy. The problem is they don't go far enough, right? So it's a weird thing. In some ways, capitalism is still thriving because it has appropriated some of the best practices of having workers have a say and work together and that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, they're able to use that to oppress workers more, and especially in places like the U.S., reduce jobs and the quality of jobs. So it's a really weird or interesting, whichever way you want to look at it, tension. And I don't know exactly what we should do about that, except to say that I think in some ways I'm hopeful that even the neoliberal companies are in some ways moving more towards some other things. But the other thing that makes me hopeful, which is the second way I wanted to answer that, is to think about the move toward privatization and the ways that the co-op movement in Emilia-Romagna in Italy have handled that. And even though in the Emilia-Romagna region they've been privatizing and downsizing and things like that, the response, because they're from a very, I guess, liberal, progressive co-op region, has been to privatize toward cooperatives, right? In fact, worker co-ops, in fact, what we call social co-ops. And I'm very excited by that movement, and I do think that that kind of a movement can grow and should grow and will grow in the United States. So the social co-ops are worker-owned co-ops that provide social services in some way. So you could count teachers, but often it's counselors, psychologists, child care providers, drug rehabilitation workers, people in all those kinds of social services. And as the government started to privatize those services, instead of providing them through municipalities and government-owned agencies, the privatization, a lot of it happened as co-op development. They have laws now that actually encourage social service workers to join, create their own worker co-ops, and they can still tap into the public money in the sense that if you have somebody who's on disability, their public money can go to pay for you to service them as a disabled and to help work with them. So there's a growing group of small to medium-sized social cooperatives that are really doing a lot of the work that we originally thought the welfare state should do. And so, of course, no one's happy that the welfare state is not doing it, but at least if they're not doing it, having co-ops do it and worker co-ops do it seems to be a good compromise or a good solution. And it seems like these worker co-ops are growing. The other thing that's really exciting for the Italian model is that they also have another level of worker co-op, which is what they call Type B. And that's where the social service worker, as part of the therapy for the mentally challenged, for the disabled, for the recovering addicts, they actually help some of their clients to create worker co-ops as part of the therapy and part of the ways to help them. So recovering addicts and returning citizens might be doing landscaping or tutoring or other kinds of small businesses that they're also owning as worker co-ops. So we have a nice system there with a lot of interlocking different kinds of worker co-op addressing a lot of the issues in society. So that's the social co-op kind of notion. And it seems like in the U.S., we don't have those laws, but we are moving toward more and more worker co-ops in some of those areas. And the final way I would answer it is I also think that one of the ways we have to approach this growing neoliberalism is to actually bring industry and manufacturing back to the U.S. And again, one of the ways we can do that is through worker co-ops. Because we have seen, in fact, the United Steelworkers are working on this with the Mondragon, which is the other great worker co-op example in northern Spain, and they're trying to create more worker co-ops in industrial world, especially like with alternative energy, solar energy, recycling. I'm trying to think of what some of the other examples are. So again, using the co-ops to solve sort of social problems, but also to help re-employ or employ people and to bring back those high-quality jobs, I think, are the major ways that we're able to fight this neoliberalism. And in some ways, we're under the radar. So I'm hoping that we can get a critical mass of these kinds of co-ops established in the U.S. before anyone decides that it's a problem and tries to attack it full force. But I may be too Pollyanna-ish on that one.
You mentioned in one of your articles about plans that had been put forward in Jackson, Mississippi by the mayor Lumumba to create an entire cooperative economy. Can you describe how he saw that there? And then can you connect it also to maybe what happened in Detroit? Mike, our engineer, and I were talking about Detroit before we got you on the line. Can you contrast what his vision was with what has happened there and then in Detroit?
When Mayor Lumumba got elected, one of his platforms was to really change the economy so that everybody could work, but also the economy would be doing things that would help the community and solve community problems. And also, I think the mayors before him had started to privatize a lot of things like the waste management and the recycling and that kind of thing. So one idea he had was that he could do what the Italians did instead of just having them go to private, for-profit, sole proprietor companies. These services could be given or earned by worker co-ops that would be doing the recycling, doing the waste management, that kind of thing. So he had this idea of sort of taking back a lot of those privatized businesses, taking them back for communities so that they'd be worker-owned companies. And then he also wanted to help promote more worker ownership in general around Jackson, both to solve the unemployment, also to solve the low pay issue, and to kind of create a better, a more sustainable and stable, prosperous economy for Jackson. I guess he had, is it three prongs? I'm not sure I have the right number, but anyway, probably three prongs. The first prong was actually education. So that 2014 Jackson Rising conference was all about education. Its original plan was to educate about 5,000 Mississippians about what is a cooperative, how to start one, et cetera. So it was supposed to be a sort of massive training program that could then launch a whole citywide co-op incubation project and then to continue to do co-op education and co-op incubation so that, again, these kinds of businesses that I just talked about could be formed, and you would have people who understood how to do it. So the first prong was education. The second prong was this identifying the industries and sometimes even firms that could be transitioned into worker co-ops. So, again, looking at the companies that had just been privatized that used to be city-owned, looking at businesses where the owner was ready to retire and had no one to turn the business over to, so thinking about succession plan and turning those over to their, and selling the business to the employees, that kind of thing. So that second prong was to figure out what businesses would be good to go into, either new businesses or these municipal service businesses or these succession businesses. And I guess the third piece was just his, you know, political platform, to have enough of a groundswell of people who were supporting him so that you had people who wanted to do the training who were petitioning their city council members or aldermen, I can't remember what they're called in Jackson, and making sure that there was that public pressure, right, to keep doing this, that the rest of the city council saw that people really wanted this kind of economic change and these kind of economic things. So the real kickoff was supposed to be this Jackson Rising Conference, which still happened even though he was dead by the time they put it on. And then that Jackson Rising would launch the rest of this program. And then the hope was that there would be at least the recycling co-op, I guess, that would be sort of the first of many that would take off. So a lot of momentum was lost because Lumumba died. But the conference did happen. Now, it didn't have 5,000 people, but it had about 600 people, which I think we all can fairly say was the largest cooperative conference of predominantly African Americans, maybe since the Young Negroes Cooperative League's first conference in 1930 or something. So significant conference, even though it didn't live up to its original plan. And Cooperation Jackson is the name of the group of some of Lumumba's followers and supporters who then regrouped themselves outside of the city government and now are doing urban farming. They're still trying to do the recycling co-op. They have a building called the Lumumba Community Center where they are doing education and have a co-op cafe. And I think they have one other project underway. It's gone much slower than they expected, but they're still trudging along and moving along. The connections with Detroit are the two cities probably have very similar issues. Detroit probably even worse than Jackson in terms of industries have basically left. Lots of people who actually were relatively skilled because they had worked in some skilled industries but now have no work at all. A lot of vacant properties. So Detroit, my understanding is, has a lot of informal urban farming going on and stuff. Lots of opportunity to kind of think about how to re-industrialize the city, particularly starting with the small worker co-ops and moving out from there. I went to Detroit once or twice to talk to some of the food security movements and some of the co-op development centers there, and they're trying to connect to the urban farming and use the local produce that's coming out of the urban farming and then do co-op restaurants or community-owned restaurants. I've seen some groups also trying to get back the industrial centers so that these, what's it called, make-it centers, where young people and other people can share equipment to actually make things. One of my groups, the Solidarity Economy Network, the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, is actually having a conference with our Canadian partners. We're doing a sort of North American Solidarity Economy Summit in Detroit in April, and we're trying to highlight the things that are happening in Detroit, but also talk about the issues of deindustrialization, racism, et cetera, and how the solidarity economy, which is sort of co-ops and broader non-exploitative economic relationships, how we can push those forward in a city like Detroit.
In terms of externalities is what they call them, where these massive corporations are generally forcing the cost of environmental cleanup or environmental damage or damage to the community or damage to human rights onto the rest of the world so that they don't have to pay, therefore take more profit. Has there been studies that show the contrast between that unsustainable behavior in that case with what cooperatives generally do?
Some of us are looking for research on that, and there's not a lot yet. There was one study in Canada which was a little bit discouraging because it said that co-ops aren't any more ecological than any other business. But a lot of us have been arguing that because co-ops are so local-based and owned by local community members who live and work in the same place, that just for that reason they're a little bit more ecologically minded, because they have to live in the same place that they work, and if their workplace is polluting it, they're not going to be happy with that. And also a lot of the newly emerging markets for co-ops are in sustainable energy and recycling and clean up things and stuff. So in some ways, the intuitiveness is that co-ops are much more about ecological sustainability and ecological transformation. We don't know yet because there aren't enough studies to really tell us what's going on, but we do know that those are a lot of the areas that co-ops are emerging in to address those issues and to do those industries. So I don't know exactly how to answer your question, except I think the promising growth is to see so many co-ops, particularly worker co-ops, going into solar energy and alternative energy, to be doing a variety of recycling things, to be doing waste management. There's a new really exciting worker co-op in Boston called Cero, C-E-R-O, that I think that they're doing something in waste management and recycling, and mostly working with low-income people of color in Boston. And they were able to buy trucks and things like that. There's, as I said, the waste management project in Jackson, Mississippi. There's a new co-op starting in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. They're trying to solve the water runoff problem, where, you know, toxic water is going into the drains and back into the water system and into the rivers and that kind of thing. And they're using a worker co-op model for that. Those are the two areas where we're seeing the largest growth in worker co-ops, at least in the U.S., in the social services and in the ecological recycling. So if that's true, then even if we can't prove that co-ops in general or the old-style co-ops are more ecological, we certainly know that the growth in the worker co-op movement, one of the areas, is that area. And it's very promising because we're solving, again, community problems at the same time that you're providing decent work and democratizing the economic structures and employment.
There seems to be from my reading, a growth in the number of cooperatives. Do you think that that is validated by real numbers when you do a larger look?
It's a little of both. What I would say is this. The co-op movement in general is actually constricting in some areas and growing in others. So there's definitely a constriction in some of the agricultural co-ops and some of the old co-ops, like the big granaries and things like that in Canada and the U.S. They've definitely been demutualizing. And even the credit unions, there's fewer in number, though there seem to be more members, even though there's fewer credit unions. But part of that is because the regulators have been forcing credit unions to close, so that's a whole other issue. But at the same time, certainly there's a market growth in worker co-ops and food co-ops. And I think because worker co-ops and food co-ops are innovative ways to solve immediate local economic problems. Also, we've been in pretty terrible economic times. You know, we had the greatest recession since the Great Depression, that kind of thing. So I think we're seeing that, at least on a more grassroots local level, the issues about food security and issues about creating better jobs, at least, as I said, in the social co-ops and the ecology, seem to be really important. Worker co-ops are particularly growing among urban immigrant communities, often because they can't find other work, and so they're finding that working together solves a lot of things. We're seeing, as I said, industries that seem to be needed in the local community are being created by people who want to work together in co-ops, so those are the ecological ones. We're also seeing not just consumer food co-ops, but also food services, right? So the bakeries of the Arizmendi Group in the Bay Area are really I guess what, they're up to six now, catering co-ops, even low, small level ones, and then some co-op restaurants and things seem to be jumping up in New York City, Boston, some other areas. So I think we have to really start to disaggregate the co-op world when we've been talking about what's happening with co-ops, because it's very different when you look at some of the older, more established co-ops, and then when you look at these younger, new models, smaller, more grassroots co-ops. And the growth is really in these younger, smaller, grassroots, worker-owned co-ops, as I said, that are really looking to solve a variety of problems and are being either created by people themselves who are coming together to do the work, or by nonprofits and other community organizations that are really doing social entrepreneurship and social mission co-ops. That seems to be, I think, where the growth is. And I would say rightly so, because that's really where the needs are. So for me, it's exciting to see that co-ops are continuing to do what they've always done, is identify needs and solve economic and social problems. And I see co-ops doing that in the U.S., so I'd like to see more, but at least they're doing it.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. She's also just been elected to the U.S. Cooperative Hall of Fame, and she'll be inducted May 2016 in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are finding more and more evidence that human behavior is not rational, not conscious, and may be completely programmed without our rational thinking. That's the subject of two books. The first one is called The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. And we also have another book called Red Genes, Blue Genes: Exposing Political Irrationality. We've got both authors with us. Shankar Vedantam is an award-winning science reporter at The Washington Post and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's written The Hidden Brain. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Maria. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. We also have with us Guillermo Jimenez. He's a professor of international trade at the State University of New York, and he's the author of Red Genes, Blue Genes. Welcome, Guillermo.
Great to be here.
So you're both talking about an irrationality, but you're approaching it slightly from different places. So why don't we start with Shankar and your findings? You open, actually, with this story of a rape victim and how she misidentifies a rapist, but she's certain that this was him. She's memorized all these parts of his face and his body so she can report it to the police. And then she made a mistake. The jury made a mistake. He spent 13 years in prison. And you say this was an unconscious thing that happened to her that was partly determined by her mood and emotions and other unconscious things. Explain that.
Well, this is a really tragic story, Maria, involving a woman called Toni Custis, who was raped in Massachusetts about a decade and a half, two decades ago. And what distinguished her, I think, is that she was a remarkably conscientious eyewitness. She took great pains during the crime to memorize the features of the man who was committing the crime. But over the course of the next weeks and months, as police showed her many, many images of people whom they thought might be potential suspects, and then eventually the person whom they thought was the suspect who had committed the crime, her memory of the case degraded to some extent, and she was pretty sure the police had the right person, but there was a little bit of a doubt at the back of her mind. And she spent that Christmas with her family at a church that had long been a source of comfort and solace for her. And while sitting in the church, her doubts slipped away, and she told herself that she had gotten the man, that it was the person who had raped her. As it turned out, a DNA test conducted about a decade later showed that this man could not have been the criminal. And it prompted Toni Gustas to go through a very lengthy period of recrimination and wondering how she could have made the error she made. The point that I was trying to make in this chapter and that I make throughout The Hidden Brain is that we regularly think that people's intentions are decisive, that if someone means to be a good eyewitness or a good juror or a good judge or a good politician, that they are a good juror, judge, or politician. It turns out that there is much in our lives that lies outside the boundaries of our conscious awareness. And in this church where Toni Gustas' doubt slipped away, in some ways I make the argument that reassurance and solace were not her friends in this situation. Her doubt that was at the back of her mind was actually her friend, because it was telling her something is not quite right.
What had happened, in particular with this, there were all these emotions that had come into place and that had her really make a misjudgment.
I think that's right. And the ironic thing in this case was that she was someone who had been through a traumatic event, and you can see why it would be most understandable for her to seek a situation where she was comforted and had some solace from the situation. But she was also in a position where she was being asked to make a very difficult judgment. And the point that I was trying to make in this chapter is, without her intending to make a mistake, in fact, with her intending to do things exactly right, and she was a really conscientious, diligent person, and someone whom I respect and regard very, very highly, she yet made this mistake. And the point that I was trying to make is, if this mistake can happen to Toni Gustas, it can happen to any of us.
Right. Now, you have talked about some other really important phenomena that deal with race, with gender, and even when people are conscientiously trying not to have that be an issue, how they are still programmed, in essence.
Indeed. I think the much of the book that I've written looks at the question of the unconscious very broadly. It's sort of how we make unconscious bias affects our romantic decisions, our financial decisions, our moral decisions, our political decisions. And one of the domains that I explore at some length is the question of unconscious prejudice. There has been a really explosion of research in the last 10 or 20 years looking at unconscious prejudice, how to measure it, what effects it has. And the striking thing again here is that, we pay a lot of attention to hate crimes or people who explicitly say racist things or sexist things. But it turns out that at an unconscious level, prejudice exists in very, very, very large numbers of people, perhaps even among most people. And these effects are subtle. They're not sort of the person who is, burning a cross on someone else's lawn. This is a person who may have an unconscious association in their heads. But when they are asked to make a decision about whether somebody is guilty or innocent of a crime, or whether to hire someone for a job, these unconscious associations play very powerful roles, especially because most people do not believe the unconscious exists. And so we have no way to guard against the manipulation, because we don't even realize that we are being manipulated.
I thought one of the most convincing parts of your book was dealing with gender bias, and the only way they could really measure it was with transgendered people. And so here you had, for example, somebody who transgendered from a woman to a man, and suddenly same person, same qualification, same education, and the income went up, and
right.
The interruption stopped.
That's right. So the challenge I was trying to explore in this chapter is that there is abundant research showing that on average, women are not paid the same as men. They face all kinds of challenges compared to men. But when you're asked to make a judgment about any individual person, say Hillary Clinton, it's very difficult to apply the general research on bias to an individual, because in any individual circumstance, there are many other factors. How good a candidate is Hillary Clinton? What are her positions on the issues? What's the competition like? And so on. But then I realized that there was a group of people who, in effect, could become their own control groups, and these were people who were transgendered. And I found remarkably that there was research showing that when men transition to being women, their hourly salaries drop, and often drop quite dramatically. When women transition to being men, their hourly salaries on average rise. But the real effects of sexism are actually much more subtle than just a question of salary. Men who become women experience losses of all kinds of privileges that they didn't know they had, And women who become men experience sort of the relief in some ways of being carried by a current that they didn't even know existed, and that's stronger than them in some ways. So it's a disturbing chapter in many ways, but the transgendered, who themselves, of course, face many challenges because they're transgendered, offer us a very, very powerful and insightful window into the nature of sexism in the United States.
There's one other phenomenon I want to have you talk about before we bring Guillermo back in, and that is this chapter that opened with the fate of a young woman, Delitha Word, and how she was essentially tortured and beaten to her death among a crowd of people who stood there aghast at what was happening, but nobody took action. You said that if one person would have taken action, perhaps the whole crowd would have moved. Talk about that phenomenon.
Well, I think this phenomenon actually has been widely described for a very long period of time. It's called the bystander effect in psychology, and there have been many cases like this, the Kitty Genovese case in New York some years ago, for example, showing that often when terrible things unfold, we intuitively believe that it's a good thing to have many people around, because if there are many people, then surely there will be some good Samaritans among them. It turns out that the opposite is true, that you're more likely to have people come to your aid and assistance when there are a few people rather than many people. The insight that I've tried to bring to this chapter is to try and show that the bystander effect doesn't just affect our ability to act in the service of other people. It affects our ability to act in the service of ourselves. And I try and show that in disaster settings, when we receive an ambiguous warning of disaster, the same thing happens when we are confronted by somebody else who is in danger. When we're surrounded by large groups of people, in some ways, groups rob us of our autonomy and our ability to act in intentional ways. And there is very compelling research showing that these forces played a very large role in the events that unfolded on the morning of September 11, 2001, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center in particular.
And the South Tower in particular because?
Well, the South Tower was the second tower to be hit that awful morning, and there was a 16-minute window between when the first tower was hit and the second tower was hit. And a substantial part of this chapter talks about a financial trading firm that was spread over the 88th and 89th floor of the South Tower. And after the rubble had cleared, I showed that nearly everyone on one floor had escaped the building and survived, whereas nearly everyone on the other floor stayed behind at their desks and perished. And my point was not so much that one group made the right decision and one group made the wrong decision. We know, of course, the group that left was making the right decision, but we know that in hindsight. The point that I'm trying to make is that in crises, people tend to act together. People are either silent together or they act together. They either intervene together or they're passive together. They either flee together or they stay at their desks together. Groups rob us of our autonomy when crises break out. And this is something that has a great deal of consequence, not just for our ability to act in moral ways, but for our ability to protect ourselves and those we love in times of disaster.
Guillermo Jimenez, you actually bring an extra element into this, which has to do with kind of the genetic part, kind of a biological predisposition towards political outcomes.
One of the arguments that I make in the book is that not all of us, but most of us are born somewhere along with a left-to-right political disposition. And that influences our political orientation throughout our lives in kind of the unconscious and unperceived way that Shankar was talking about. And so the great majority of us do have some political bias that we're guilty of, but we tend to not perceive it because it lies in the unconscious, and we have a lot of techniques of self-deception to prevent that from rising to our consciousness. But we perceive it very well in the other party. And that's one of the funny things about irrationality, is that we can see it in others, but not in ourselves. And TV commentator Glenn Beck, who for me is kind of almost the incarnation of political irrationality from a liberal perspective, and he's so obviously biased that anything that Obama does or that a Democratic administration does, he's going to criticize. He's going to come in against it. And he doesn't perceive that bias, but we as liberals do. On the other hand, I think, you know, the insight that I propose in this book is that as liberals, we are not immune to this kind of irrationality. I mean, we've got Blagojevich, we've got David Patterson, we have our guilty parties as well. And in a very similar way to the way that Republicans or conservatives view politics from a biased perspective, we do as well.
This way that you opened your book, you talked about how you were watching Orrin Hatch, and from every fiber of your being, everything that you saw, heard, the way he wore his hair, the way he wore his tie, the way he spoke, his accent, everything made you recoil. You said, in essence, his DNA really upset your DNA. And you said that this is especially now prevalent on both sides, and that this political irrationality is driven by a number of phenomena. I think partly you're saying there's a genetic base to it, but I think Shankar's piece also here, and some of the research you brought in terms of groups and in terms of emotions. And the question I think I'm trying to get to is, how much of it is this media blitz that we're getting on both sides? And we've all read the works of Cass Sunstein. And how much of it is really a distinction between them? Guillermo, why don't you start, and then let's see what Shankar has to say.
Research that I cite that's very interesting, there's a professor named John Hibbing out at the University of Nebraska that's done some just incredible groundbreaking research in the field of the biological basis of our political dispositions. I'll just mention, you know, very briefly, one of his experiments got a group of people that he had categorized previously through questionnaires as very liberal or very conservative. And he exposed them to these startling stimuli, like loud noises, gruesome photographs, and then he measured their involuntary responses. And what he found is the people that were more instinctively fearful, that corresponded with conservative political orientation. In other words, those people were more likely to support defense spending, the Iraq war, capital punishment, patriotism, whereas the people that showed a calmer or less fearful instinctive response were more likely to support pacifism, liberal immigration policies, foreign aid, and so forth. And what that suggests is that there is a biological component, which may be slight or may be slender, but is definitely present and detectable in our political opinions. And what's kind of shocking to us about that is that we don't perceive it ourselves. You know, we think that we come to all of our political opinions through some exercise of logic or reason. And I argue that it's about 50% genetics. But what's even more concerning is that on top of that genetic layer, we also have a cultural layer which also reinforces biases and prejudices. So most of us end up doubly prejudiced or biased in our politics, partially our biological inheritance and partially from our social upbringing.
Shankar, what would you add?
Well, I certainly think Dr. Jimenez is right in terms of the idea that I think there are certain biological predispositions to political orientation. The thing that I find fascinating about our divide is twofold. One, why is it so much more intense today than it was, say, 50 years or 100 years ago? You know, our biology hasn't changed, but if you look at the number of Democrats who are passionately against a Republican president and vice versa, the gap is just extraordinary today compared to where it was 100 years ago. And the other thing that I find really intriguing, and this is really in some ways a puzzle to me, is when you look at many of the issues that divide liberals and conservatives, they don't fall along what you would call logical patterns. So, for example, conservatives are against government intervention in general, and they want sort of a hands-off, laissez-faire policy. But when it comes to abortion or family values issues, they want a very interventionist government policy. They want sort of government to be involved in sort of running people's lives or telling people, here's what's appropriate and here's what's inappropriate. The striking thing here is not, I'm not trying to point out necessarily that one side is being hypocritical, because I think Guillermo is right in terms of saying that both sides are guilty of this. The interesting thing is why it is that people don't see these inconsistencies themselves, that when you're on one side, there's nothing that your side can do that feels wrong, and there's nothing that the other side that can do that feels right. And I've seen some very interesting research from political science that argues that in many ways, the driver behind partisanship is sort of the same driver that's behind our passion for our sports teams. So, you know, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, and when I think about it, it's absurd to be a fan of any single football team, because these are players who are interchangeably going between the different teams. They just happen to be wearing one set of colors. But, you know, when I'm watching a game, my team can do no wrong, and every ambiguous call of the referees make, I sort of say, well, you know, they made a mistake and they should have given it to the Eagles. And I think the same thing is happening at the political level as well, that we sort of identify with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in the same way we identify with sports teams, and that in some ways causes us to to fail to see the inconsistencies of our own positions and fail to see the weaknesses in our own side or any good in the other side.
You know, there was some research done a while back in political psychology that showed that membership of a group, even if it's completely arbitrary,
right,
automatically creates an us and a them and creates competition. Perhaps that's a missing element, and that's the thing that needs to be understood. Guillermo, you actually also talked about this phenomenon. What do you have to say?
I think the example or the symbol of the sporting contest is a great one, and was actually used in a lot of the psychology research. You know, students are assigned to watch a basketball game, and they're randomly assigned to one or the other team. And what we discover is within minutes, they become very biased in favor of that team. And that is quite similar, I think, Shankar is right, to the bias that we exhibit on behalf of our political parties. But I would say to his point, you know, why is it increasing? Why are we perceiving it to be such a problem these days? Well, there are a number of reasons. The first thing I would say is there are some political scientists at Princeton, Nolan McCarty and Keith Poole, who wrote a book called Polarized America a couple of years ago, that studied the history of polarization in the Congress, and they found that polarization in Congress increases in times of economic stress. And when we are trying to rewrite our fundamental social contracts, it kind of makes sense that we'll get more polarized. We've got healthcare reform. It's going to change our country. And so when things like that are on the table, it's kind of natural that you'll have some polarization. But on top of that, you have the phenomena of the modern media and the internet. One thing that Cass Sunstein says, you know, Maria mentioned earlier, is that nowadays, you know, we can get all of our information from biased news sources. And a lot of people do. I mean, there's a lot of people that watch Fox News, and then they read the Wall Street Journal, and they read Ann Coulter's books, and they're not going to get a very fair and balanced view of reality that way. And then finally, on top of that, you add the modern media circus, which makes money from this conflict. And, you know, the great example is our political presidential campaigns, where all of the media giants just run political shows all day long. And how do they get eyeballs to those shows? It's by presenting us figures like Sarah Palin and divisive figures that rile up our emotions and get our eyeballs glued to those TVs. So, you know, we have a number of factors working together which have given us kind of this perfect storm of polarization that we're now in.
I'd actually like to also bring in, since you're talking about media, the issues of fear and loathing, which you say are the most dangerous parts of political irrationality. Guillermo?
Yeah, well, I think we need to fear political irrationality. I think the insight I want to get across in my book is that we have to examine it in ourselves, and we have to be wary of political appeals to fear and to hatred. And I think, you know, on the liberal side, you know, I feel that right now we don't have a lot of appeals to hatred. Maybe we did during the Bush era. There were liberal, a lot of liberals hated George Bush. Now, I think the problem, you know, on the liberal side is that not only on the liberal side, but on both sides, our politicians attract our attention by creating fear in us. And liberals, unfortunately, can be as guilty of this as conservatives. You know, conservatives present a frightening picture of liberal statists who want to, you know, control your very life. And liberals present this counter portrait of, you know, hateful, racist, corporate, warmongering conservatives. And the result is not a happy one for our political environment in general.
You know, that reminds me of something that Shankar wrote about, which was about terrorism and extremism and how there is no real psychological profile that's different between a suicide bomber and somebody else. What does this mean to us, Shankar?
Well, this was a chapter that looks specifically at sort of extreme behavior. And I try to make the argument, Maria, that even though it seems as if that terrorists come from dysfunctional backgrounds or dysfunctional personalities, there has been systematic research conducted among people who attempted to be suicide bombers, their missions failed, and now they're in prisons all over the world. And the research into these people shows that they are hardly more aberrational than the rest of us. In many ways, they may suffer from fewer mental illnesses. They seem to be more idealistic than the rest of us. And nor is it the case that they are particularly more religious than the rest of us. And I find this particularly striking. If you look at the history of suicide terrorism, actually, religion turns out to be neither necessary nor sufficient as an explanatory factor for suicide terrorism. What is common to suicide terrorism in different eras, from the Japanese kamikaze bombers in the closing days of World War II to the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers in the 1980s to, you know, the various suicide terrorist outfits today, is that suicide terrorists typically are formed in an environment where they're essentially cut off from the outside world for a variety of reasons. And in our normal lives, most of us get pulled in different directions. You know, we have ties to our families and to our churches and religions and sports teams and professions, and, you know, this creates stress in our lives. But for the suicide bomber goes into what I call the tunnel. And within the tunnel, the person doesn't face the conflicts of the outside world. All of the reference points within the tunnel are the reference points created by people within the own group. And when you have this, what you have is a dynamic called small group psychology that takes over. And one of the things that small group psychology can accomplish is it can change the norms of what's good and bad behavior. So what seems aberrational to us outside the tunnel can become aspirational to the people within the tunnel. And so when we ask, why do suicide bombers do this aberrational thing, what we're not really taking into account is that we're standing outside the tunnel. We're not seeing how the norms have been systematically turned upside down within the tunnel, that is the suicide bombers' framework.
And that, of course, is very much like Zimbardo has taught us in terms of the what he calls the Lucifer effect. And I think that would bring us also, Guillermo Jimenez, you talk about these entire histories that are completely different from left and from right and what ends up taking us to war. And maybe this is what we're going to end on. Talk about taking us to war and how the left and the right see this in opposites.
Probably the most eminent scientist in this whole field of bias is a man at Princeton, Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2002. And he developed the whole modern theory of cognitive bias. Why are we biased? Why do we come to wrong perceptions, wrong conclusions? And he applied these theories to modern conduct of war in an article called Why Hawks Win. And what he observed was that, you know, most of the cognitive biases that we've discovered in the past 40 years tend to favor sort of a militaristic, warlike approach. And that if we examine the conduct of leaders as we lead up to war, we find a lot of impact of the most common and cognitive biases that humans are subject to. I think probably the classic example is the Iraq War. And one of the most common biases that plagues human beings is our overconfidence bias. Human beings are tremendously overconfident. And the great example there was Vice President Cheney predicting that, you know, the American soldiers would be welcomed in Iraq as liberators. And, you know, anybody who's read what's going on in Iraq knows that that was never the case. So that's just one example of how our biases expose our leaders to go to war.
Guillermo Jimenez, thank you so much. Shankar Vedantam, thank you so much for being with us. Shankar Vedantam is an award-winning science reporter at The Washington Post and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's written The Hidden Brain. Guillermo Jimenez is a professor of international trade at the State University of New York, and he's the author of Red Jeans, Blue Jeans. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.